From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
Believe me, there's no collusion. Russia is fine. But whether it's Russia or anybody else, my total priority, believe me, is the United States of America.
A week for the history books. Day after day after day of reporting about the Trump administration, Russia, and the FBI. We'll tackle it all in our Week in Review. Also today, Senator Elizabeth Warren encourages young people, regardless of party, to dive into politics.
One voice is powerful, but two voices is more than twice as powerful. And 10 or 10,000 voices become a force to be reckoned with.
And what does Beethoven have in common with Justin Bieber?
You know, you're a composer. You've only got a bunch of notes. What you can do with notes is not that fundamentally different.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's Friday, time for the Week in Review, and OMG, what a week, starting with Monday night's revelation that the president shared classified information with the Russians.
What the president discussed with the foreign minister was wholly appropriate to that conversation and is consistent with the routine sharing of information between the president and any leaders with whom he's engaged.
This is not just a joke. This is very serious business that relates to the security of this country. This president needs to have some grown-ups around him that make very clear what the lines are here.
And then on Tuesday evening, revelation number two reports that Trump asked former FBI Director James Comey to drop the investigation of Michael Flynn.
Did you at any time urge former FBI Director James Comey in any way, shape, or form to close or to back down the investigation into Michael Flynn? And also, as you look back...
No. Next question.
Then on Wednesday afternoon, the Justice Department named Robert Mueller as special counsel to take over its Russia investigation.
It's like a breath of fresh air has come into this week-long saga in that I think he is someone that has support on both sides of the aisle. You've heard barely a complaint about him, which is quite unique.
And then yesterday, on Thursday, President Trump fired back.
The entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians. Zero.
So here we are, Friday of a week that I'm convinced will become its very own chapter in future American history books. And with us now to sort through it, it's Titiana Deering, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Titiana, it's good to see you.
Thank you. It's scary to be here.
And also with us is Zuri Berry, Deputy Managing Editor for News and Multimedia at the Boston Herald and co-host of Newsfeed on Boston Herald Radio. Zuri, it's great to have you back as well.
Thank you. Thanks for being back here.
Okay, and the week's news is not yet over, right?
No, it is not.
Because we just have this brand new report from the New York Times that literally just got published, just crossed. Times reporting that President Trump told Russian officials in the Oval Office this month that he had fired James Comey, and there's according to a document that summarized the meeting, the president apparently said, "I just fired the head of the FBI. He was crazy. A real nut job." That's what the Times is reporting just now, that the president told Russian Ambassador Kislyak and the Russian foreign minister as well. Titiana Deering, I'm going to take a breath here. Off to you. What do you make of it?
Well, that's why I said it's scary to be here, because I was afraid I might be 10 seconds out of date from sitting in the chair and miss whatever crazy thing came next. It is very hard to behave oneself after a week like this, right? The word nut job may be being thrown around by the wrong person in the wrong context. And after the kind of week that we've had, there is nothing that I could find out happened in that conversation with the Russian officials, I think at this point, that would surprise me. Mm. It's a stunning lapse of judgment and professionalism and quality leadership. And in fact, that leadership dimension is something I feel like we haven't talked about as much, but is really important in this. Is this the sign of a decent leader? It's not.
Mm. Well, let me, Zuri, before I come to you, let me just play a little bit of tape here, because I want to get the president's voice in here as well, because he had a lot to say, because he just gave a press conference yesterday. He took a couple questions. And one of them, of course, had to do on his reaction to Robert Mueller being named special counsel by the Justice Department. And here's what the president said.
There was no collusion. And everybody, even my enemies, have said there is no collusion. So we want to get back and keep on the track that we're on, because the track that we're on is record-setting.
Zuri Berry, your thoughts.
First of all, I want to know what enemies he's paying attention to, because I think that there are plenty of Democrats that are concerned and at least expressing their interest in exploring a full airing of facts in regards to this investigation and to the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. On top of all of this, I mean, you know, we're looking at a whole week full of major news, and I'm just looking at the latest news from the Times as well as the Washington Post. But this escalation of rhetoric towards James Comey, I think, is incredibly important to note that the White House is obviously viewing the former FBI director as an enemy, and they are, you know, sort of directing this language that he's a crazy, he's a nut job. According to Sean Spicer's statement there, he was grandstanding and politicizing the investigation and all of these things. And mind you, in his sworn testimony, that he, you know, went to great lengths to not sort of speak towards the actual investigation in a public forum. So I think that there is a real concern about what Comey knows, what he is going to reveal now that he's been fired. And obviously they're worried about the fact that he was taking meticulous notes on his conversations with Trump and what that means towards possibly damaging the president at this current time.
Yeah. So you referenced the Washington Post story, which just crossed as well. And that has to do with the fact that the Post is reporting that the law enforcement investigation into possible coordination between Russia and the Trump campaign has, quote, identified a member of President Trump's inner circle in the White House right now as a significant person of interest. Okay, so much going on here. I want to actually step back and get hear some voices of analysis that we talked to this week. And one of them is Admiral James Stavridis. A retired admiral, I should say. He's the dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He also served as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe. And given that experience that he had, I asked him this question. If you were working in this administration right now and you had to brief the president, would you trust him with the information you were giving him?
You'd have to. The system won't work otherwise. And I think hopefully this entire episode will be something of a cautionary tale, although let's face it, other controversies haven't modified President Trump's behavior very much.
Tiziana, I wanted to play that tape because, you know, the daily drip, drip, drip of news is one thing, but underlying all of that is the functioning of the Trump administration, the functioning of the federal government, and also the health of our democracy here. And here we had in Admiral Stavridis someone who had to take a deep breath before answering that question, and the best he could come up with is, if he were in Trump's inner circle right now, he would, quote, have to trust the president, even though he didn't sound very confident that he could.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of the sub-conversations that's been going on this week is the scattered dismay you hear about the lack of resignations, the lack of protests from the people working in the White House and working in the administration. And one of the challenges with a leader who is, I will say, behaving incompetently is the decision about where can I do the best good and the least harm? And I think we're not having a full insight into, but are experiencing an administration where there have got to be good people who are trying to make this calculation right now. Do I resign because participating in this is damaging democracy? Do I stay because I have a sense of somebody's got to contain and protect and ensure quality? And I refuse to believe that there aren't some people who are experiencing those challenges and trying to find their way through it. I will come back to it is only when there is crummy, crummy leadership at the top that's even a conversation that has to happen.
Zuri?
Well, there's obviously a group of people who have a different sense of right and wrong within the administration and within the intelligence community that are seeing the actions of the president and determining that they want to make sure that this information gets out there. That seeing what he did in the firing of James Comey is something that they thought was going to impugn him, and so that they wanted to sort of change the narrative. And that we've seen that occur, you know, immediately, especially when it's the attacks on Comey's integrity have come directly from the president or Sean Spicer, who obviously, you know, he's going so far and saying he was grandstanding and politicizing this. So I think that we're going to continue to see that there is a group of people who want to be in the middle of this and maybe not make themselves known, but continue to leak against the president. And, you know, that's some right. of these leaks are illegal. That's obvious.
Yeah, and but so that's why they don't bother me.
There's a personal risk there, but these people obviously feel very strongly about what the president has done, particularly when he's giving information to the Russians or talking about
yeah.
Comey.
You know, we have career government servants here that we're talking about.
Deep state.
And, well, deep state's one way of looking at it. That's taken on some pejorative terms, yes, depending on who you are. But the point I wanted to get to is that, you know, just yesterday we spoke with former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, and he had told New York Magazine back in February that he doesn't like leaks. But on the other hand, he sees sometimes leakers doing so out of a sense of moral obligation and patriotic duty. And he didn't disagree when I asked him about it again yesterday. And that's what got me thinking that you know, yes, some of these are absolutely illegal and people are taking a risk. But clearly their sense of concern, patriotic concern for the functioning of the federal government is high enough that they're willing to take the chance, TC, on that.
Yeah, I heard that interview with Chuck Hagel yesterday. I think the term that he used was that there will be a gusher of leaks. And in fact, somebody said to me the other day, somebody who tends to represent the other political viewpoint from mine, well, don't these leaks bother you? Don't you worry about this undermining of the government? And I admit that I have experienced the leaks as at least what I perceive to be patriotic action. For the most part, I do worry about the extent to which it was necessary, for example, for us to know that the intelligence came from Israel. Mm, was that right. necessary? Did that make anything
yeah.
better?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. And I would say that there is a great number of people out there that are very much concerned that the leaks have not necessarily been for the good of the country, but instead just to damage the president yeah. himself and whatever his agenda may be. As we've heard time and time again, that his legislative, you know, priorities have taken a back seat as far as the cleanup has gone in the past week for all these scandals.
Mm. Well, I want to play another piece of tape here. I'm getting back to the president's decision to fire James Comey as FBI director. He spoke about it yesterday and he said this.
Director Comey was very unpopular with most people. I actually thought when I made that decision, and I also got a very, very strong recommendation, as you know, from the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein. But when I made that decision, I actually thought that it would be a bipartisan decision, because you look at all of the people on the Democratic side, not only the Republican side, that were saying such terrible things about Director Comey.
Okay, so just as an update here, yesterday and today we're hearing that Deputy AG Rod Rosenstein is saying that on May 8th, he learned that the president intended to fire former FBI Director James Comey and that the president, quote, sought my advice and input. And so then Rosenstein gave it to him. So, you know, the order of operations here, there's he said, but Zuri, let me just turn to you here. This is all sort of hovering around the rest of the news. I mean, what do you make of Rosenstein feeling compelled to speak out?
Well, I honestly don't think the timeline matters as much. And I do think I have a different take on this. I do think that the president obviously had his reasons. Those are out there and very public at this point. And I do think it is okay for the deputy attorney general to have his own reasons, that he could have been approached by the president and said, look, I want you to look into this matter and, you know, write up a memo. And instead of, you know, putting to paper the president's viewpoints, he found his own or had his own already looking at how Comey conducted himself in the Clinton email investigation. And there were some serious concerns, I think, that was expressed on the Democratic left-leaning side of the aisle about how he conducted himself, the language he used, how that language was used to further diminish Hillary Clinton during the campaign. Mm. And so I think all of those things were sort of the mix of law enforcement turning into sort of a prosecutorial aspect of the FBI. And that was concerning in its own right. So for him to use that as a justification, I think is possibly separate than what the president sought for.
Tiziana, your thoughts?
So too. I mean, yes, I think that I find that to be a compelling point, and it makes me think about how far past cynicism we have now extended, because the timeline, in fact, doesn't necessarily matter because nobody even remotely believes anymore that one set of arguments given for something are the actual first set or are true. The other thing that strikes me, if there's time, Magna, honestly, that quote where he says Comey is unpopular with most people, I swear, I sometimes wonder if this president thinks the phrase most people is a substitute for the pronoun me, you know, and
the people close to me.
Right. And you know, he's like a wrecking ball of id, and nothing can escape his own referential frame of how he's perceiving the
information. But to be fair, there's still above 30% of people in regularly polled who think the president is doing a job, who approve of him, and, you know, those people, and 30% of America's millions of folks, absolutely, they thought that Comey was trying to undermine the president. So maybe that's not most people, but that's a lot of people.
It is. You know, I heard a caller on another NPR show saying that his defense of the president is the president can do pretty much whatever the heck he wants, right? Well, if that's what you believe, if you believe that the elected leader of a democratic country, that the threshold is he can do pretty much whatever the heck he wants, then you think this guy's doing a good job, because we all have to agree he's doing pretty much whatever the heck he wants. I just don't think that's a good criteria for how you evaluate the leader of a free democracy.
Okay, so let's touch on the other big news. Well, another chapter in this week's news about the Trump administration, because, of course, we also heard, as we mentioned earlier, that the Justice Department has named Robert Mueller, former FBI director, to be special counsel in its investigation into possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. Mueller's appointment was widely and positively received on both sides of the aisle. Interestingly, though, Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, had a quite nuanced take on Mueller's appointment. Respect, but also concern.
I respect the decision. Mueller's a good guy, but one of the big losers here is the public. Because we're not going to hear from Comey now, most likely. I hope we do. I want to hear about the conversation. I want to know the context of it. But now that you have a special counsel, maybe that's off the table.
Okay, so Graham there referring to the conversation a Comey memo says that he had with the president about dropping a Russia investigation into Michael Flynn. Lots of names flying around here. But to the bigger point that Lindsey Graham is making, Congress still has an investigation going on.
Yeah.
And multiple investigations. And he's saying, hey,
take a back seat?
Does it take a back seat?
And I think that is a valid concern. And I think that if it's a congressional investigations, the House or the Senate, whatever it may be, I think that there is, again, an airing of facts that occurs in a public setting where we can either set the record straight or you know, finally prove or disprove whether or not there was a collusion and let that be known immediately. Whereas we will have to wait if the special counsel, Robert Mueller, decides whenever his investigation is done, we're going to have to wait until that point in time in which we have a clear understanding of what occurs here. And mind you, I don't know what the process is going to be, and I don't know if it's been fully explained either what the process is going to be when that investigation wraps, whether or not there is going
right.
to be
what kind of
a public hearing,
exactly.
and whether or not that we are going to get a sense of the investigative steps that occurred in order for us to fully determine whether or not there was wrongdoing done and to what extent.
Yeah. So, Tiziana, before I come to you, I want to play another piece of tape about this issue because I think it's very, very important for the public. And I asked former federal judge Nancy Gertner about this, and she actually said that, yes, a special counsel could impede or interfere or complicate the investigations taking place in Congress.
Mr. X is called before the House committee or the Senate committee. Mr. X is a target of Mueller's investigation. Mr. X takes the fifth. Mueller doesn't have to say anything. Mr. X simply takes the fifth because there's a pending investigation. Mm-hmm. He's not directing anyone on the House or Senate to do anything, but he can create a situation in which witnesses will not comply.
Now, Tiziana, here's the thing. This is how the system works, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, in Iran-Contra, we saw the flip side of this, congressional investigations ending up having an impact on the Justice Department's investigations, which led to the reversal of convictions later on of Oliver North, right? And John Poindexter. But the point is like the public is so riled up right now. I'm just wondering how they're going to respond if indeed we do have a situation like this where someone like James Comey himself, who's at the center of this maelstrom, raises his hand and says, I can't answer these questions.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. I've seen this so many times before. There is a difference between the arc of human experience or emotion, the arc of public policy, and the arc of legal process. And we often will see those things not aligned, right? And we're going to see that here. The arc of the legal process may create a situation where at different times people would like information now and they don't get to have it. And while I find that unfortunate, it is so essential at this point that at the end of the day, the American public feel like this process and investigation was bulletproof. That if we have to deal with some mood swings while we wait for a quality investigation that we have, I think, at least increased reasons to believe will be done thoughtfully within the bounds of the law and thoroughly, we may have to deal with the mismatch between the arc of human emotion and the arc of legal process here.
So one more piece of tape here, and this takes us back to my conversation yesterday with former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, because meanwhile, you know, governance does go on, even if it's grindingly slow right now. The president, as we speak, is on his way on a major foreign trip. He's going to go to the Middle East, visit Saudi Arabia, visit Israel, nations at the heart of Israel, especially of this week's news. And, you know, how effective he's going to be, what impact this week's news is having on our alliances, all yet to be seen. But here's what, again, former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said about the erosion of trust he believes the administration is suffering.
Everything the president says, the White House says, what comes out of the White House, they affect our international relationships. They affect our ability to govern. I mean, we're paralyzed, completely paralyzed.
Zuri Berry, are you as equally pessimistic as Hagel is?
Yes, just a short answer. And the issue is that there are a number of stories, and again, the Washington Post just put out a story that has essentially, a couple sources anonymous about a White House official being now at the center of this inquiry into sort of Russian connections. But the concern is that if the White House wants to tamp that down, they don't have any credibility to do so. Mm-hmm. And we saw that early on in the week with the sort of trotting out of the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, who also damaged his credibility by saying that this wasn't true and then having to go back the next day and sort of explain that. And as one by one, everybody's sort of losing some credibility here by having easily disproved or having the president sort of undercut their messaging every single day. And so I think the former defense secretary is completely right in this respect that they are getting to a point in which we are very much concerned about the integrity of the entire building.
Yeah. So, Tita, let me ask you, I mean, people's opinions about the president himself are pretty set in stone, I'd say. But about all these other folks surrounding him, how do you think Lieutenant General McMaster can regain his credibility in the eyes of people who say he's lost it?
I don't know that he can. And I think that's part of a challenge for us. You know, you don't fully appreciate a loss of moral authority until the moment when you desperately needed to have moral authority.
Yeah.
From a national security perspective, thank God we haven't gotten there yet in this administration. But when you've seen that much damage to credibility, and, you know, granted, I'm not sure we've had moral authority around the globe, but we've at least had soft power authority that we've lost. I don't know. I can't imagine the thing that McMaster does that suddenly makes people say, oh, from now on, the first thing that comes out of your mouth we'll believe was the correct thing.
Yeah. Well, we have just enough time for our hubbubs. And I know that sounds crazy at the end of an intense news week like this, but I think we should do it anyway, right? Because the weather's beautiful and let's have a little bit of lightness here. So, Titi, I'm going to start with you. What's your hubbub?
Well, so my hubbub is tied to a Saturday Night Live skit from this last Saturday night that involved the Lester Holt interview with Donald Trump. And I think you guys have some of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I fired him because of Russia. I thought, he's investigating Russia. I don't like that. I should fire him.
But that's obstruction of justice.
Sure, okay.
Wait, so did I get him? Is this all over? Oh, no, I didn't. Nothing matters. Absolutely nothing matters anymore.
So actually, I had a second part to my hubbub, but I'm not going to use it. Because actually, if you look at the conversation that we've just had here, I guess my hubbub is, please, let's not have that be right.
Yeah.
Right? Let's not have that sadly hilarious Saturday Night Live skit turn out to be right.
Yeah. I think this is one case in which it's funny but wrong, because yes, everything does matter. Zuri Berry, your hubbub.
All right. Mine is a little more close to home, I guess. I'm actually looking at the tomorrow's 11 a.m. ribbon cutting for the Jamaica Plain Library.
Yes. Okay? It looks so beautiful.
This is a $10 million renovation. Okay. This is a huge deal, obviously, locally. And back on May 9th, they had a community meeting to discuss the Dudley branch renovation. That's going to be another $14 million. The Mayor Walsh is looking at about $102 million from financial year 19 to 22. Next year, it's got another $14 million. So all of this is happening in this sort of beautification effort of these very important institutions, and our libraries being one of them. Dudley needs it, okay?
Yeah.
Dudley needs it. It looks bad, and I would hope City Hall comes next. My only other point is this sort of undercuts mayoral candidate Tito Jackson a little bit. He's investing money in his neighborhood, and I think it looks good for the mayor, and it takes away something from Tito's against him.
Politics never far from anything. My hubbub is a quick one. Apparently, the most controversial thing that happened in the Netherlands this week, we've discovered that the King of the Netherlands is flying KLM. He's a pilot on KLM. He's been doing it for 21 years.
Yes.
Awesome. Tiziana Deering and Zuri Berry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back. It's been quite a week. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Boston City Hall is one of those landmarks that we love to hate. The brutalist architecture has been called drab, ugly, and severe. But a group of artists this month hopes to transform the building with a collection of strange and surprising installations. As WBUR Artery reporter Amelia Mason explains, they hope the public can see beauty and find meaning in the oft-reviled structure.
Straight up open. I love the windows at the top.
Marilyn Arsim stands in Boston City Hall's airy front lobby. She tips her head back to take in the vast concrete expanse that soars 9 stories overhead to a hazy shaft of sunlight at the top. Arsim points to a chiseled protrusion about halfway up the wall.
But now, is there a place you could stand on that overhang, you know, like at the top of it?
Up top, no.
Arsim is a member of the Boston-based experimental art collective, Mobius. The group is planning an art installation to refashion City Hall's solemn gray interior, using sculpture, sound, video, and performance. Arsim is joined by fellow Mobius member Jane Wong, who describes one piece involving trombone, tap shoes, and jump rope.
And a jump rope, that's right. And she'll be jump roping while Tom is with a trombone, and he'll start on the 5th floor, so they're going to be playing off each other with the acoustics.
A different performance piece will tinker with the speed of escalators to upend visitors' sense of time. There will be giant sculptures, interactive performances, and original music, like this composition by Zaid Booty. For Wong, who grew up in the Boston area, curating the performances has changed her perception of City Hall.
Even though I have to admit, I still think this building is pretty ugly. I feel a fondness for it now. It has a lot of personality. It's just when you just look at this big cement thing, it just feels very heavy. But when you come in here and once you start to appreciate just pockets of it, I think you can see the beauty in it. So it's an ugly, beautiful thing.
Wet cement, hideous. A lot of different words I've heard people say.
Patty McMahon is the city registrar and has worked in Boston City Hall for nearly 30 years. The concrete style, commonly known as brutalist, was popular in the 60s when it was built. But McMahon says the design is impractical. It's difficult to hang pictures on the hard cement walls. Wires and piping hang exposed. And on the first floor where she works, there are no windows. McMahon says that each administration has taken a different tack with the building.
I think first initially it was to make it livable, and then it was in the Menino administration to make it have wires and run so you could actually use technology. And I think in the Walsh administration it's really looked at how do you actually make it pretty and comfortable and light.
You used to be able to come out, walk up into this atrium, then down a stair and across the street.
Chris Grimley of the design firm Over Under leans over a map of City Hall in his office in the South End.
You could come in this way, go up into the atrium, walk back out that way, right?
Grimley says the layout was meant to foster a sense of porousness and accessibility. With its deep-set windows and towering concrete brow, City Hall can seem fortress-like and forbidding. But Grimley says the design was rooted in high-minded democratic ideals, part of a huge and successful urban renewal project that revitalized Boston's decaying downtown and restored faith in a government once riddled by corruption. City Hall was designed to be welcoming, transparent, a place for the public to gather.
For instance, people don't realize that you could walk from the Government Center T stop down the plaza up into the courtyard. There's an elevated courtyard that exists in the center of the building, which is a completely remarkable space, which has skylights that flood the space below.
Grimley says that over the years, the building has suffered from neglect. And now, for security reasons, there's only one point of entry, the front door, something not likely to change in our post-9/11 world. Grimley is working with the city to recapture the civic spirit of the building, and that's where Mobius comes in.
I am building this sort of tentacular, low-level inflatable sculpture that sort of seeps over the edge and oozes out onto the floor.
Artist Jesse Kaminsky stands on a mezzanine overlooking a hallway and points to the ledge where he plans to install his sculpture, a huge, puffy anemone made of colorful Tyvek that undulates with the aid of a fan. Inspired by the artist's love of early science fiction movies, the creature will creep over the edge of the balcony, infusing somber City Hall with a feeling of comical unease.
I wanted to make this sculpture that was very soft and very, like, floppy and forgiving and kind of funny in a way.
The sculpture is meant to contrast with the building's severity and disrupt its sense of order. Kaminsky has great aspirations for his piece, but he's not sure how it will come across to the public.
You know, I feel a little honored to be able to come into this area and bring in something that is not a sure thing, because I think failure and that sort of possibility of failure is super important in the creative process and in the municipal process as well, even though it's harder to admit that.
To some, City Hall represents just that, a failure. But to the artists of Mobius, it's become a source of inspiration, even beauty, proof that Boston City Hall, in all its flaws and peculiarities, might still be worthy of love.
That report from Amelia Mason for the WBUR Artery. Well, it is that time of year when robes and mortarboards and tassels abound. And this morning, Wheelock College held its commencement ceremonies. Featured speaker, a former teacher.
Hello, Wheelock! Woo!
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
It is a real honor to be the commencement speaker at this historic institution. Wheelock College was founded in 1888 as Miss Wheelock's kindergarten training school. People were taught how to deal with unruly five-year-olds. We could really use that experience in Washington today.
And as you might expect, that wasn't the only jab Warren threw at President Trump today. Jokes, deserved or not, aside, Warren had a deeper message for Wheelock's grads.
I wanted to be here in part because it was a day, this was an opportunity to honor someone who changed my life, and it was my second grade teacher, Mrs. Lee. She gave the best hugs in the world, and I loved her dearly. And one day she took me aside and she told me that I could do something with my life if I wanted to. And later on, I remember standing in front of her and telling her I wanted to be a teacher. And she rocked my world when she said, "Yes, Miss Betsy, you can." No one in my family had ever graduated from college. No one had ever said I could do anything. But after Mrs. Lee told me that I could be a teacher, I stood a little taller, I spoke a little clearer, and I organized all of my dollies into Let's Play School. And it was a long road, and there were some bumps along the way, but I made it. And when I graduated from college, my very first job was working with special needs kids in a public elementary school. Teaching isn't just a job, it is a calling. So let's hear it for our teachers.
But Senator Warren also told the grads, it's not enough to find a career that fulfills a calling. There's just too much at stake in today's world, she said. So she urged them to do more.
I like to get all of you more directly involved in policy work.
As Warren pointed out, politics and policy affect everyone. Policymakers set the student loan interest rates the grads will be paying. Policymakers will influence the cost and availability of the health care they need.
Last week, during the debate over health care legislation, one congressman said he shouldn't have to pay for maternity care because he was all done having kids. Ha, ha. What a clever guy. You know, something like that really wants to make me say, come on, guys, this is 2017, not 1817. And we are not talking about the weather. We're talking, for some people, about life and death.
So Senator Warren encouraged the Wheelock class of 2017, Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike, to do three things. One, find an issue that really matters to the core of who you are.
Take the time to think through who you are, if you know what you believe in and what you're willing to fight for.
Two, study up on that issue.
Study up, because knowing something about an issue makes a difference. So go online and read the facts, not the alternative facts, the real facts.
And three, find a group that makes a difference.
One voice is powerful, but two voices is more than twice as powerful. And 10 or 10,000 voices become a force to be reckoned with.
And why did Warren urge every graduate to embrace their inner wonk and dive into policy work? Well, she did so for the most unwonky of reasons. The future of American democracy, she said, depends on you.
Your generation faces huge challenges, sharp differences that divide nation along deep fracture lines, intergenerational challenges that have saddled young people with an unprecedented $1.4 trillion in student loan debt, an economy that is producing great wealth for the top 10% and locking out everyone else. If democracy for you simply means leaving it to others, letting others set the terms of the political debates, and surrendering the policy decisions to people in faraway Washington, then our country will work better and better for a smaller and smaller number of people. But if democracy for you means connecting up, studying, making thoughtful decisions, and defending them with intelligence and commitment, then this country will flourish. I believe in you, the class of 2017. Your Wheelock degree has put you on the right path, and I know you have great work ahead. It is an honor to share this day with you. Congratulations. Thank you.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. She spoke this morning at Wheelock College. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, it has been a long week, but the weather is gorgeous and Friday is finally here, so let's celebrate the day with a little joy. Beethoven's Symphony No. 1. It's about as classical music gets. But conductor, composer, and author Rob Capello will make you hear Beethoven in a completely different way. Rob Capello has made a name for himself over the last 27 years with his What Makes It Great series, dissecting the hidden majesty within some of the best-known musical compositions. And ever since Capello came into our studios last year to dissect Beethoven's Symphony No. 1, we have never been able to listen to Beethoven or pop music the same way. Rob Capello, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So I do want to hear you talk about Mr. Beethoven, but I understand actually that you want to start with something else, not Beethoven's first. What is it?
Well, I thought I would start with the obvious predecessor to Beethoven, which would be Justin Bieber.
Oh, my God. Okay. I'm going to digest that for a second, but play this Bieber song that you want to play.
Well, here's a little of this sort of early Beethoven predecessor music. You gotta go and get angry at all of my honesty.
You know I try, but I don't do too well with apologies. Okay, so Rob, can I tell you something? There are many things that I never would imagine would come together in this job of mine. And
I've just lost my conservatory degree retroactively.
Justin Bieber and Beethoven? Okay, I'm all ears. Explain.
All right, well, you know, it's interesting. I've spent a lot of time looking at mythology, and this great writer, Joseph Campbell, talks about mythology a lot. And, you know, he said in the first 20 years of his life, he was just stunned. He would research all the world's myths, and everywhere he went, he would find all these different myths in different cultures, and he was just overwhelmed by the diversity of it. He said then the last 20 years of his life, what he was really overwhelmed by was the fact that they were all the same. That they were all telling the same kind of story, but in their own local languages. And, you know, it's been the same thing with myself and this What Makes It Great stuff.
Yeah.
I've done these What Makes It Great programs on every different kind of music, from Gregorian chant to Duke Ellington. I even did one on Javanese gamelan music and, of course, classical music like Beethoven. And in the first 15 years of doing it, I was just struck by how different all these languages were. But recently, I've been struck by how similar they are. In other words, what makes a great musical idea? What makes something catchy? What makes you remember it is not that fundamentally different. Now, obviously,
can I just jump in here for a second?
Sure.
Because what makes it great and what makes it catchy, not necessarily the same thing.
No, but we got to remember that Beethoven, as great as it is, was also entertainment music. And I think what makes an idea catchy is not fundamentally different. You know, you're a composer. You've only got a bunch of notes. What you can do with notes is not that fundamentally different. And the thing, the reason I picked Justin Bieber is because you can see a lot of basic principles in an incredibly clear way in a Justin Bieber song that are used in a much more complex, refined way in a Beethoven symphony.
So what are some of those principles? And I'm really, really curious.
Well, good. We got you on the edge of your seat, which is the whole point. Now, you know, one of the things that I've really been struck by is this brilliant quote by the composer Stravinsky, who says, and this is really about music, but it's really about life as well. He says, all composition is a balance between unity and diversity and variety. In other words, too much unity, too much repetition leads to boredom, but too much variety leads to chaos.
Okay.
Now, in the introduction of that Justin Bieber song, there's actually only three chords, and the whole song has only three chords except for one magic moment at the climax of the song, which adds a fourth chord on the highest vocal note of the whole song.
A pop song with four chords? Oh, my God.
Three.
So
now, here
four.
Are these
okay.
three chords. But, you know, how does music tell a story? Even in three chords, you can tell a story. This first chord is a kind of an open chord. It's what musicians call a chord in fifth. Each one is a fifth apart. But it's kind of an open chord like this, not a normal chord. That's a normal chord. So he has this chord. Then the second chord is rich and fuller, more dense. But then we resolve on the third one. And there's already a sense of a little narrative in that story. We start open and hollow, we move to dense, and then we resolve. A story in three chords. Now, what do we got above that? We've got a little catchy riff above it. We've got this. Now, how do you know it's a riff? Because you repeat it a second time. And then you have a pause, a moment of pause. Now, a pause for a great composer, whether it's Justin Bieber's writers or Beethoven, is always an opportunity because a pause is something you can fill in later.
Yeah.
So there's a moment you'll hear. Now, also, if you listen really closely, and I'll play it again for a moment, you'll also hear a really cool little offbeat. You'll hear, and that little thing in the background is what makes it interesting. Now, we then repeat the whole thing. How do you know something's an idea? You repeat the whole idea a second time. But now, instead of stopping, you fill it in with the kind of key ritornello lick, the thing that you're going to keep coming back to over and over again, which now makes a huge impression because it was absent first. Listen to just that introduction one more time. Notice the three chords. Notice the little riff. Notice the little pause, notice the little offbeat, and here's just that introduction.
Okay.
Pause. add the riff. You see, that's just the introduction.
I feel my resistance to this idea starting to break down.
Okay, good. Well, we've got a little bit more to go. But I mean, it's an introduction in the sense that an introduction to a Beethoven symphony introduces the main materials. Because believe it or not, those are the three chords of the entire piece. Now, when you hear the next part, it doesn't sound like those are the same three chords. Listen. You gotta go and get angry at all of my honesty. But in fact, if you listen to the lowest note of those chords, that's what's going on in the bass here.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, unity, variety. We're now repeating the same basic idea, but now we're varying it. Now, also again, one of the basic principles in music, you've only got a few notes to use, so you better be careful how you parse them out. As Sondheim says, less is more. Now, he starts off using only two notes in the vocal line, then adds a third note, makes a punchline with the fourth note. So we're using four notes, but first just two, add a third one, add a fourth one. Then repeat the same thing. Only four notes. Still, only four notes. How do you make a punchline? You add the fifth note. That's the new note.
Okay.
And then what do we come back to? Our little Ritornello idea.
Yeah.
And you know, the amazing thing about this song is that's it. You're using only five notes for the entire two verses of this song. How do you make a chorus spectacular? You'll hear in a minute. What you do is first you make an airplane crescendo into the chorus, and then suddenly you use all these high notes that have never been used before. We've only been using this note. When we get to the chorus, it's... And now it sounds huge. Again, it's all about comparison.
Rob Capello, you know, as you were talking and I was listening, literally for about 3 minutes, I forgot we were talking about a Justin Bieber song.
Well, that's the whole point. That's what I'm saying. You know, what music does with its materials is not that different. I mean, Beethoven does it in an incredibly spectacular way, as we'll see in a moment. But how you work with a musical idea is not that fundamentally different.
So I am now officially going to give credit to Julia Michaels and Justin Tranter, who wrote this song.
Yes, it is not Justin Bieber's song.
But you know, So I get your point about the commonality and the similar tools, right? That we hear here. But we've only got a couple minutes left, about 3 minutes left before we have to sign off for today. So let's talk
about
how
Beethoven.
Beethoven does it. Yeah.
All right. So now here's the beginning of your Beethoven symphony. Okay, unity, variety, and repetition. Now, say I do this rhythm for you four times. Ba 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 ba. The two of them are interesting. By the fourth one, you're bored out of your mind. Ba 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 ba. He could have written ba 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 ba. But he writes ba 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 ba. The difference between ba 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 and ba 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 ba. It's the ba 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 ba. It's just like the Justin Bieber. It's what makes it varied. Now, he could have also continued. But it's ba-da-ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. And then just like Justin Bieber, he adds the orchestra right on that last ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Woodwinds on the first one, brass on the next one, saves the timpani for just the last note. The perfect musical punctuation mark. All right, so we've now got this fantastic idea. Also notice it's getting higher.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting louder. More instruments are being added. This is what makes it so thrilling. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Change. Higher. Now, watch this. He finishes, starts the next idea with a simple idea. Now, he could have had all the instruments doing this accent together like this. Accent, accent, accent. But instead of this, he has the lower instruments play on an offbeat. Offbeat.
Uh-huh.
Offbeat. And then instead of going, he explodes on the offbeat and has the bass come in like this. So instead of a boring idea, ba ba da ba da ba ba ba, we've got offbeat, and explode.
Wow.
Now, then, here's unity repetition. You got an idea, just like Justin Bieber. So what do? You do it lower to lure you in. Then immediately you shorten the idea. Instead of ba da ba da ba 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 da, you just make the ending. Ba 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 da. Everyone expects. But instead, we go from this beginning, sigh, sigh, repeat and finish. Do it lower. Sigh, sigh, repeat and finish. Now just to the end. Repeat and finish. And here's the big moment, the punchline, just like Justin Bieber. And repeat and repeat and finish and finish and finish and finish and stop.
Okay.
You've got the longest musical phrase anyone has ever written in the history of music.
Conductor, composer, raconteur Rob Capello spoke with us last year. You can find more information about him and his What Makes It Great series at our website, radioboston.org. Have a beautiful weekend, everyone. Thanks for sticking with us. We were going to go out on Beethoven, but Poppy Friday. It's going to be Justin Bieber. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
I know you know that I made those mistakes maybe once or twice. And by once or twice, I mean maybe a couple of hundred times. So let me all.